I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israel ramped up strikes in the Gaza Strip and Lebanon, targeting Iran-backed militant groups Sunday, the day before Israel marks the one-year anniversary of the Hamas-led attack that killed 1,200 people. Relentless airstrikes pounded the southern suburbs of Beirut that are considered a stronghold of Hezbollah, and Israel increased its air and ground operations in Gaza, where Hamas is based. Those strikes included one on a mosque that killed 19 people. Crowds across the world took to the streets on the eve of the October 7th anniversary, AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
In Turkey, protesters chanted, "Murderer Israel, get out of the Middle East." In Pakistan, a sea of Palestinian flags engulfed the city of Karachi. In Morocco's capital, Rabat, thousands marched by the parliament. They called on Morocco's government to revoke its 2020 agreement formalizing the country's ties with Israel. The recent protests follow massive rallies that took place in several European cities, including London, Madrid, Paris, and Rome. In Australia, thousands gathered in Sydney and Melbourne in support of Palestinians and Lebanon. In Tel Aviv, relatives of the hostages took to the streets to protest against Israel's government, demanding the hostages are brought home. One relative, Ella Metzger, thinks Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has gone too far and is not listening to the Israeli people.
Israel is not democratic anymore.
At a rally in Berlin near the Brandenburg Gate, hundreds of pro-Israeli demonstrators marched with a banner that read, "Against all anti-Semitism," accompanied by a police escort. I'm Karen Chamas.
This is VOA News. Haiti's prime minister has traveled overseas to seek security support after last week's gang massacre. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports.
Haitian Prime Minister Garry Conille embarked on a trip to the United Arab Emirates and Kenya this weekend to seek security assistance in the aftermath of one of the deadliest gang attacks the country has seen in recent years. Grand Griff gang members stormed through the western Artibonite town of Pont-Sondé on Thursday, killing at least 70 people, including children, and forcing over 6,000 residents to flee. The massacre caused widespread shock in a country that has grown accustomed to outbreaks of violence with little police presence. Last week, the UN Security Council authorized another year of international security force to help Haitian police fight gangs. The mission has so far made little progress.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. Rescue and recovery efforts continue in the southeastern United States following the recent landfall of Hurricane Helene. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has the story.
The storm so far has claimed more than 220 lives, making it the deadliest since Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Officials say the federal response is robust and underway. Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, Administrator Deanne Criswell, speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week, as provided by the social media platform X.
We've got thousands of responders on the ground right now, along with thousands of volunteers and the private sector, working alongside our state partners, the National Guard, the first responders in the community, meeting the needs of the people on the ground.
Parts of the southeast remain underwater, with power stations completely flooded. The region now braces for Hurricane Milton. The National Weather Service predicts it could become a life-threatening storm before slamming into the already hurricane-ravaged Florida coast on Wednesday. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
Samoa's acting prime minister said late Sunday an oil spill from a grounded New Zealand Navy ship that sank and caught fire off the coast of Samoa is, quote, highly probable. Officials in the Pacific Island nation are conducting an environmental impact assessment in the area where the ship sank on Sunday morning. New Zealand's chief of Navy said all 75 people on board were taken to safety on life rafts. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Monday, October 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tunisians are with results from Sunday's presidential election.
It's not a real election in the sense that there are over 100 political opposition figures who have been jailed. There have been dozens of potential candidates who have been disqualified.
Kenya's Deputy President Gachagua, who is facing impeachment, asked for forgiveness from President Ruto. Democratic Republic of Congo starts mpox vaccination. Today, Monday, is the day that Ugandan President Museveni's son has given for the U.S. ambassador to apologize to President Museveni or leave Uganda.
We are not surprised that General Muhoozi could now reach a level of threatening diplomats, but it speaks to the record that there has been impunity by those who are occupying state institutions.
And a deadly year for journalists as the Israel-Hamas war marks 1 year today, October 7th. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tunisians are awaiting results from Sunday's presidential election featuring President Kais Saied and two challengers. Reuters news agency quotes the election commission at saying that the turnout was 27.7%. President Saied has been criticized for jailing his main challenger and dismantling democratic institutions since he came to power. Journalist Noura Hafai joins us from the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
The total number of voters is 1,381,176 voters. It was noted that there was greater turnout at the polling stations from the youth and the elderly, and we explained the different opinions. There are people who say that the election results seem to be decided in favor of the outgoing president, and in this case, we do not have to perform our electoral duty. Others say we are going to vote so that the ballot box does not remain empty. But most say that Kais Saied must win because he will rate the corrupt.
Do Tunisians think that the election will be free and fair, given that the main opposition candidate is in jail?
Indeed, observers believe that the biggest challenges facing the Tunisian people and their relationship with the elections are the lack of media freedom and Saied's control over the electoral committee. Perhaps the most prominent thing that can be shown of this is the imprisonment of the main opposition candidate, Ayeshi Zamel. Really, as a journalist, I am no longer able to do my job as before. I have become afraid of speech, expression, or presenting the truth. And unfortunately, I do not consider myself free in my country as a journalist.
That's journalist Noura Hafai speaking with us from the Tunisian capital, Tunis. As Tunisians are with the results from Sunday's presidential election, an analyst says the country's democratic transition has failed because of the actions of President Kais Saied. Samer Shihata is an associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He tells me that Sunday's election was a coronation, not a real vote.
Well, it's not a real election in the sense that there are over 100 political opposition figures who have been jailed. There have been dozens of potential candidates who have been disqualified. And one of the three last remaining candidates is now in jail. In addition, President Saied has limited the power of the High Court to rule on election matters and has handpicked the people on the election committee. So it's not much of an election. The outcome is known. Saied is going to win. And what's also known is that Tunisians aren't taking it seriously, and they're not going to go out in large numbers and participate.
Could it be that President Saied has done something, for example, economically? Has he done something good for the country besides the decline in democracy?
So there are a number of reasons why we got to where we are today. And you're right to put forward a contextual factor, which is democracy hasn't delivered economically. That is, people were hoping that their economic lives would improve significantly. Some might remember that there was very high unemployment, and particularly youth unemployment in Tunisia in 2011 when the Tunisian revolution, the first of the Arab Spring, took place. The former president, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, was incredibly corrupt and had been in power for 23 years and so on. The economic situation has not improved, and there are just as many people unemployed today as there were then. And in fact, many people claim that the economic situation was better before the uprising. That's a contextual factor. But President Saied has been autocratic. He staged a self-coup in 2021 in which he dissolved parliament, in which he dismissed the head of government, and in which he has been ruling by decree for the most part since then. He changed the constitution. There were bogus parliamentary elections in which less than 15% of the population turned out to participate, realizing that they were bogus. And since then, as I mentioned previously, he has jailed many opposition figures who remain in jail today. The most leading political players in Tunisia are in jail. And so that, I think, is the primary reason that we are where we are today and that the democratic transition in Tunisia failed. Not because Tunisians don't want democracy, but because of the actions of President Saied in consolidating his power.
Samer Shihata is Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. Kenya's Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua has asked for forgiveness from President William Ruto, a motion to impeach the Deputy President for alleged corruption and financing the recent anti-tax protest was made last Tuesday in Parliament. The Kenya Nation reports that the Deputy President made the appeal for forgiveness on Sunday during a prayer service held at his home. Political reporter Barack Udwa of the People's Daily tells me the die is cast and that Deputy President Gachagua most likely will be impeached.
The deputy president held prayers with close members of his family in his Nairobi home. He decided to ask the president for forgiveness. He also asked members of parliament for forgiveness as well as Kenyans for forgiveness in a bid to try to soften the heart of members of parliament and probably the president who are having upper hand in the impeachment on Tuesday. Remember, the public participation on his impeachment ended yesterday.
What is the likelihood that this appeal for forgiveness might stop the impeachment proceeding?
We do not think that it might be of any significance. One, because President William Ruto today himself attended a church session in Nairobi, but he steered clear of speaking about the impeachment of his deputy. We think that the die is cast, and on Tuesday, there is a very strong reasons to believe that the deputy president will be removed from office.
Is it true that there has been some attempt to intervene by other citizens so that the impeachment will not take place?
Yeah, sure. It's not only citizens, but there are attempts here and there. There is attempts by a section of political leaders. There is attempts by a section of elders or community leaders, where both the president and his deputy are coming from, especially the Kikuyu Elders Association, like from community where the deputy president is coming from. And during the public participation process, it came out so clearly that majority of Kenyans are not keen about the impeachment process. They see it as a distraction from the real issues affecting citizens. They are appealing to the president and parliamentarians that there are other pressing issues bedeviling the country rather than impeachment.
Tell me, has this kind of thing happened before?
Yes, this is the first time it's happening under the new constitution, the Kenyan 2010 constitution. Although it had previously happened, the first vice president, Jaramogi Oginga Odinga, the father of Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga, who resigned in 1960s after falling out with the first president or the founding father of Kenya called Jomo Kenyatta.
Barack Odwa is the political reporter for the People's Daily of Kenya. He was speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Monday, October 7th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A Ugandan member of parliament is expressing regrets over remarks made by President Yoweri Museveni's son, General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, about the U.S. ambassador to Uganda. The Uganda Monitor reports that General Muhoozi, who is also commander-in-chief of the Ugandan Armed Forces, told U.S. Ambassador William Pabb to apologize to President Museveni or leave Uganda for what Muhoozi called undiplomatic behavior. Both General Muhoozi and the Uganda military spokesperson declined our request for an interview. Nkurunyigi Muwada is the shadow minister for foreign affairs in the Ugandan parliament. He tells me that the General Muhoozi comments were provocative and non-diplomatic.
It is with great concern that we note a very non-diplomatic, provocative and rational statements issued by an officer of Uganda Armed Forces at a level and rank of the Commander-in-Chief of the Defense Forces, Ewan Muhoozi Kainerugaba, who also happens to be a son to the Ugandan President Museveni. We are not surprised that General Muhoozi could now reach a level of threatening diplomats, and in this case, the Ambassador of the United States of America to Kampala, Uganda, and equally bypassing the non-diplomatic approaches. But it speaks to the record that there has been impunity in Uganda, there has been impunity in governance by those who are occupying state institutions, including the military, armed forces, and some occupying political offices, but belonging to the National Resistance Movement.
Do you think the Ugandan government is aware of his threat? I ask this particular question because it seems that no one in the Ugandan government or the military would want to speak with us on record about this.
General Muhoozi has, for the last years, acted with impunity. He's a serving military officer. His actions have always been inconsistent with Uganda's established constitutional order. The Constitution of the Republic of Uganda, which establishes Uganda Armed Forces, makes it a non-partisan, and officers of the armed forces are by law not allowed to engage in partisan politics, divisive politics, and equally must not take on the mantle of being the occupants of those offices to take over civilian and as well oppress civilians. What we have seen with General Muhoozi, he has at all times acted with impunity just because he doubles both as a military general and also as Museveni's son to act with impunity. Now he has bypassed all this. He also wants to speak out and bypass the non-diplomatic channels to attack and threaten violence on Uganda diplomats and as well on international diplomats. We apologize as people of Uganda. This is not the people of Uganda. This is Museveni's son who is acting with impunity. And I don't even believe that the armed forces of Uganda, I don't even believe that the Uganda People's Forces sanctioned General Muhoozi's action, because we have seen in the past where Muhoozi operates with impunity without sanction of the UPDF. And many times they have denied responsibility of his words and action. Unfortunately, we are surprised, though a little, that General Museveni recently appointed him the commander-in-chief of armed forces. Now, we know the common communication of diplomatic notices, be it verbal or written, but as well, even in our diplomacy, General Muhoozi has no role. He's not a minister of foreign affairs. He's not an office of the minister of foreign affairs. And equally, being a commander-in-chief of armed forces, you don't cross over now to take over roles of other institutions.
Kunyigi Muwada is the shadow minister for foreign affairs in the Ugandan parliament. Congolese health officials have launched their first mpox vaccination campaign, a key step in efforts to contain an outbreak that has spread to numerous other African nations. Grant Leti is UNICEF DRC country representative. He told viewers Jinedu Ofor that the exercise is targeting the worst hit provinces as infections and deaths soar.
The campaign actually started yesterday in the first province of North Kivu. So this was in three, you know, high priority territory, essentially around Goma, North Kivu. And today, vaccination started in one of the territories in South Kivu, which is actually really the epicenter of the current outbreak of mpox. And then there are other provinces. Tomorrow, vaccination will begin in Chopo, on Wednesday in Equateur province. And then we are still waiting for the confirmation of two others, which are Sankuru and Sudubangi.
Can you update us as to the number of infections and fatalities, if any, prior to the arrival of the vaccines and also the vaccination proper?
So we now have nearly 30,000 suspect cases in all, and with over 900 fatalities. And as previously mentioned, around 60% of all of the suspect cases are children, who also account for over 80% of the fatalities. So the spread has continued. It's now really close to the entire national territory, which are reporting mpox cases, although some of them are reporting in the single-digit suspect cases. We remain fully mobilized on this because, as with any epidemic outbreak, it's a race against time.
Are you encountering any difficulties?
The key thing is the sheer scale of it. I mean, DRC, as you know, is an absolutely vast territory with very different, difficult logistical constraints, particularly in the rainy season, which we've now moved into. So there are difficulties, but we are used to dealing with those. I mean, we have these with other vaccination and other type of nutrition and health programs. So there's no one specific difficulty which we think is going to hold us back from actually doing what needs to be done.
Grant Leite is the UNICEF country representative for the Democratic Republic of Congo, speaking with viewers Jinedu Ofor from Kinshasa. The Hamas terror attack on Israel last October sparked a conflict that has become the deadliest in recent history for journalists and media workers. At least 116 of them, nearly all Palestinians, have been killed. VOA speaks with reporters who have covered the conflict and media analysts about why it is essential to have journalists on the ground who can work freely. Christina Casedo-Smith and Liam Scott have this story, narrated by Christina Casedo-Smith.
The October 7 Hamas assault killed 1,200 in Israel. Terrorists kidnapped 251 people. The attack ignited a war that continues to this day. Among the mounting number of civilian deaths are dozens of journalists.
More journalists were killed in the first 10 weeks of the war than have ever been killed in a single country over the course of an entire year.
According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the death toll as of October 1st is 111 Palestinians, two Israelis, and three Lebanese journalists.
There is also are very great challenges in terms of access to the story for journalists. And the story is, in my experience, the most polarizing story we've ever had to deal with in my long career as a journalist.
Tarek Hajjaj is a Gaza correspondent for Mondo Weiss, an online publication covering the Palestinian territories, Israel, and U.S. policy. He has lived his entire life in Gaza City.
And every time I was walking under the Israeli drones and warplanes, I was feeling that every second they may bomb me, specifically me, because I know they target journalists, and I know they don't want anything from Gaza to get out to the people.
Founded as a progressive news site, Mondo Weiss has faced criticism for what some say are anti-Israeli views. The Israeli government has denied on multiple occasions that it targets journalists, but CPJ and others say the Israel Defense Forces should be accountable for the high media death toll. Nearly all those who died are Palestinian.
They're also the only people able to report from Gaza because no foreign journalists have been allowed in. So they bear the full weight of responsibility of reporting on the impact of the war on Gaza.
Injury and death are not the only risks journalists face.
Some of the dangers are not just physical dangers, but there's cyber stalking and harassment and intimidation of journalists.
The United Nations had condemned the attacks on journalists, indicating that there were disturbing reports of attacks against media workers despite being clearly identified. In response to a UN report, the IDF said it does not deliberately shoot at civilians, including journalists. Hajjaj remembers every story he has covered since October 7. Some, he says, were devastating to write, but he knows it's his job to keep reporting on what is happening. With Liam Scott, Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with football. The group stage draw for the 2024-2025 CAF Confederations Cup and the 2024 CAF Champions League will be conducted on Monday. Ahead of the draws, CAF has named Guinea star Naby Keita, Egyptian legend Ahmed Fathi, legendary coach Florent Ibenge of DR Congo and South African icon Sifiwe Shabalala as their draw assistants. In women cricket news, two of the semi-finalists at last year's ICC Women's T20 World Cup will go head-to-head on Monday. South Africa will face England in a highly anticipated Group B encounter at the Sharjah Cricket Stadium in the United Arab Emirates on Monday night. Tasmin Breeds says the South African Proteas aims to continue their winning momentum in this crucial encounter.
Yeah, we've got a big game against England. As everyone knows, that's always a tough one. But we don't want to leave it for the last game. So if we can make sure we win all of the games, of course, that will be ideal to make sure we guarantee that spot in the semi-final. We never take teams lightly, even if it's a Scotland team. I mean, they're very hungry, and it's the first World Cup year. So I don't think you should think it's a walkover team. So, yeah, we're trying to do our best to make sure we're in that semi-final.
Rwanda national cycling team head coach David Lever has admitted that the highly anticipated 2025 UCI Road World Championships in Rwanda will be more difficult to compete for than the previous races. The Union Cyclists International officially unveiled the race route for the Global Cycling Showpiece, which will take place in Rwanda from September 21st to the 28th, 2025. Speaking to Dutch news outlets, Lovett said that the 2024 race in Zurich was very difficult, but predicted an even more difficult challenge in Kigali in 2025. Cyclists will cover a total distance of 5,500 meters of positive altitude difference. In taekwondo, preparations are underway for the Taekwondo World Championship scheduled to take place in Glasgow, Scotland next year. Taekwondo International Africa is making plans and preparing to win some titles at the event. A representative of Taekwondo International Africa, Job Magagula, is hoping investments in the sport can increase the popularity of the sports on the continent.
Now you have kids from rural areas specifically for the world championships, and also companies to invest in the sport because the sport is so big. So we want to grow it in Mpumalanga, South Africa, and Africa. So we need help.
And finally, in athletics, Kenyan runner Immaculate Ayango has been provisionally suspended after testing positive for a banned testosterone substance and the blood-boosting hormone EPO, according to the Athletics Integrity Unit. And that does it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. That's it for this Monday, October 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.